We must take the land route, which is easily a week's journey. And what with fears of the sickness, it's likely no inn will accept us along the way. Luckily, I have an idea, they both said at the same time. He let her go first. Ismi's idea was to travel by way of the trade route along the river, and then cross the South Sea at the Land Bridge, using the convent at Islay as a safe haven before making the rest of the journey through Deleuze. She didn't mention to him why she thought of Islay, that it was the very place to which the Deleuzian Council had planned to send her on the eve of Aurora's wedding. She knows nothing about it other than it must be trusted by the Council and therefore is likely safe. As for William's idea, he mentioned only that last night the ideal mode of travel occurred to him, and that he would show her in person. Now, as he leads her across the palace grounds and into the castle village, a church bell gongs 6 times. They move past the church, where she hears the whinnying of 2 horses and the shuffle of leather straps and buckles. A carriage. Surely he isn't suggesting they take a royal carriage. She turns to him and he explains. I was thinking about the death of Edward and Philip. That's what gave me the idea to travel as they did.
But they were killed, Isby blurts out.
Exactly, William says. There's a silence while Isby tries to make out what he is telling her. Pigeons flutter out of the bell tower above them, cooing.
Travel as they did, she says slowly, and then swallows, putting it together. In a...
William puts his hand on her back, a kind of affirmative pat. Hearse, he finishes. She has to admit he's clever. No one will think to interfere with a small wooden construct, its horses draped in black, a casket in place of a passenger seat behind the driver's perch. Then again, it means they are going to have to lie down together in a coffin.
We'll make preparations and leave tomorrow, he says.
The next day, the wind carries an angry bite to it. Isby shivers as she and William make their way back to the church at sunset. The old, gravel-voiced wagoner, one whom the prince claims they can trust with their lives, greets them gruffly and without fanfare. It's clear from his tone that he thinks what they're doing is a terrible idea. Isby wonders just how much William has offered him to take this risk, or perhaps he has no choice. It takes a few minutes to get into position in the contained space, and Isby almost laughs when William has to get out and try again with his cloak untangled. Luckily, the coffin is lined in velvet and is, of course, as yet unused. There is no smell of death and decay, only cedar and pine. It is like a small enclosed bed, and not altogether uncomfortable, although it is nearly impossible to shift around without jostling each other. The driver leaves a lid open a few fingers' width. It's enough to allow for a thin strip of moonlight and fresh air without anyone seeing in. Isby hears the driver whip his horses, and soon they are trotting along the pitted road. After only a few minutes of their heads banging together on the small velvet pillow, William suggests Isby slide down somewhat so that her face is near his chest. And then the very long and very awkward silence begins.
I think we're at the river road, the prince mutters into her ear sometime later, startling Isby, who had been nearly asleep. The road feels bumpier here.
She scrunches her brow for a moment. No, not yet.
No, I think we are. I hear the current.
Isby shakes her head, which causes her cheek to brush William's doublet.
There's a loose terret. The reins are rubbing against one of the horse's harnesses.
How can you... he begins to ask, but stops himself.
I'll let you know when we're near the river, Isby assures him.
She'll smell it. William fidgets and shifts. It must make him uneasy, not being able to see where they're headed. A thought strikes her, and she accidentally snorts.
Are you laughing at me, Isabel? He asks. I confess I'm not an expert on the thesaurus of loose carriage gear.
Now Isby actually does laugh. She's never heard anyone use the word thesaurus.
No, I just had a thought that amused me.
Which is, do entertain me. We have a long journey ahead.
I was thinking that people are so very dependent on light, either the sun or oil for their lanterns or candles. Without it, they have no idea where they're going. But I live like that, and well, I'm not saying it's better, but one could argue that it's a more honest way to be.
More honest?
More true to life, because we're all stumbling through darkness, really. None of us knows where we're heading.
Not in the bigger picture, anyway.
You're quite the philosopher, Miss Isabel of Deleuze.
She could swear she feels his smile through the growing warmth of his chest near her cheek. She smiles back into him, wondering if he can feel it too.
So tell me, he says, is your sister philosophical as well?
Right. This is all for Aurora. She's not here to make interesting conversation.
Isby thinks for a minute.
She is thoughtful and intelligent. She taught herself to read.
Really?
The prince replies, sounding impressed.
Well, there wasn't much else to do at the palace all these years, Isby says automatically. But yes, she reads very well. Less for the ideas in it, more for the stories.
She can't bring herself to say romance.
It is somehow too uncomfortable a word to say to a near stranger, especially one with whom she happens to be sharing a coffin.
Aurora is... how to explain it? She's a quiet person.
I suppose it's commendable for a woman to be soft-spoken, William says, a bit of distance in his voice. The comment annoys her.
I suppose. But Aurora isn't soft-spoken. She is silent.
She doesn't speak at all.
Isby squirms.
She will make you a good wife, she says.
That's what the entire point of this journey is, after all. William must fall in love with Aurora.
My sister can convey words to you in a single look. She is creative and joyful, patient and kind, and you must have heard rumors of her beauty.
Anyone can be beautiful, the prince says. An odd comment.
Not like her.
Well, I look forward to seeing her then.
Aurora is more than just sweetness of face and temperament, Isby says, growing frustrated with the way William's remarks seem removed, formal, as though they're discussing a prize horse to be traded. You don't know her like I do, but one day you will. She sees into the heart of things. She always knew what I needed, even before I did.
And what is it you need? He asks,
his voice again reminding her of a tree in wind, shaking leaves loose inside her. His question feels somehow too personal.
What I need is to save my sister.
So you've said.
So they are understood. Good. Silence comes again, but this time it's a little less awkward, and she begins to relax into the jostling ride, the scent of velvet and wood and lime soap that wraps around them, the faint thud of the prince's heart in her ears. Isby always liked the erratic rhythm of Freckles's hooves, and now their sound fills her mind, bringing her back to the summer day 3 years ago when she snuck out on the unruly mare, only to get thrown in the mud. She remembers rinsing herself off in the little country stream, and once again the memory washes over her. Gilbert teasing her, the two of them pushing each other playfully, falling on top of him, his hand in her hair, his lips finding hers. Tingles running through her body, the water rushing all around them, crisp and cold as they kissed and kissed. And
that, she hears William say, pulling Isby back into the present, is the sound of the river.
A warm blush spreads through her neck and face, and she's overcome with the humiliation of having relived those intimate memories in such close quarters with someone else. What if William can somehow sense the nature of her thoughts? But just as quickly, her embarrassment falls away, replaced by a tension in her chest. Gil. She doesn't know where he is, doesn't know if he's even alive. She's supposed to be saving the person closest to her, her sister, and yet she's lost the only other person she has ever loved.
Loved.
She did love him, does love him. It's a love that's both romantic and familial at the same time. Friendship mixed with trust, mixed with knowing. All that, and the desire to feel his hard, calloused hands on her skin again, or even just to have him near, his soft scent of horses and hay, his calmness. That worn river stone smoothness of familiarity. Is this what it feels like for a heart to break? She's not sure. She doesn't feel broken, only heavy, aching and sad, and a little bit sick. He might be dead. He might have died without knowing that this was how she felt.
Isabel.
William's voice is a rough whisper. She nods against his chest.
Yes, she whispers back. We've reached the river.
23. Violette, a fairy duchess of remarkable bearing, according to herself.
One is never really alone with a mirror. Add a second mirror facing the first, and one's company multiplies infinitely. So many versions of oneself, seen from so many angles. This is truth. This is happiness. Violet pities anyone with fewer than 42 mirrors in her bedroom, 247 in her grand hall, and 63 in her water closet. She even has 5 of them on her ceiling over the bed, so that when she wakes in the night with the candle still burning, as she has done just now, the million and one insects of loneliness lurking in the shadows can't touch her. Violet has memorized every inch of herself, from the wavy hair as glossy as a ruby in sunlight, to the eyelashes as long and elegant as spiders' legs, to the lips as perfectly pursed as a taut bow just before the kill. And yet, Violet marvels at the new and wonderful things she is still learning about herself. Qualities she never knew were there, never even thought possible. Like the curse, or rather, its amendment. Proof that her power is indeed enough to counter Malfleur's. The spindle. The girl's birthday. A princess asleep. It has all occurred as it was outlined 16 years ago. The only catch is the sleeping sickness. It was never meant to infect others. For a fleeting moment, Violet fears she has done something wrong. Hadn't Belle Kerr, before she vanished, brought the golden spinning wheel to Violet and asked that she keep it safe? She should never have agreed in the first place. It had given her a bad feeling all along, even before the princess was born. It had been important to Belle Kerr, obviously, or she wouldn't have asked, and Violet had felt the burden and the sadness of its presence. It had become a symbol of loss. Decades later, after the child's christening, she didn't like the object of a curse being so close to her all the time, staring at her like a big, dumb animal, majestic and silent and hungry. She resented being asked to keep so many secrets for others, when she had so many of her own to tend to. That was why she'd finally decided to get rid of it. But it couldn't be burned or melted or destroyed. So eventually she'd simply stowed the cumbersome thing away in one of those abandoned cottages in the Royal Forest. At the time, it hadn't seemed particularly foolish. What had seemed foolish would have been to believe that a fairy curse could still come true. Everyone knew how far the Fae had fallen, even then. Or maybe they hadn't. And maybe Violet hasn't, either. Surely it's not too grandiose a notion to think she might now save the kingdom. It cannot be hyperbolic to assume she, Violet, is both the source and answer to all this madness. She probably should do something about it, try another curse reversal, perhaps. Yes, she really ought to get out and let the world marvel. She tucks her fluffy covers up to her chin, watching intently as her double mimics her in the mirror directly above. She is pleased to see that this, her most favored reflection, has paid such dutiful attention. She begins to drift off again. It cannot be paranoia to assume that the night is full of the sightless and the angry people who've had their vision robbed by Violet herself. Can it? She looks up, staring into her own eyes between each heavy blink, her face almost unfamiliar in the waning, wavering lamplight. What was it she was pondering? Oh, right, the sleeping sickness. And how to end it. Then again, she thinks, perhaps it's not such a good idea to get involved after all. Going out and saving the kingdom would require interacting with other people. Seeing not just their appearances, but through to their hidden fears, their anger, their twisted, thwarted insides. And she's had about enough of that for one lifetime. With that decision made, she closes her eyes. Infinite reflections close their eyes too. Part 4. Darkness did win. 24. Isabel.
We're here, says the old driver, lifting the lid of the coffin.
As she sits up, Isby can tell that they have pulled off the side of the road into the shadow of some pine trees, hopefully hidden from any passers-by. Not that there are any. They seem to be in the middle of nowhere. Isby shivers. They haven't heard a passing cart or rider in many hours, but they have safely crossed the border into Deleuze, even if they are in the most remote part of the kingdom. They have been travelling the river road for several days. At one point they drove right through a village, where a riot had broken out after Prola Mort mercenaries showed up and demanded recruits on pain of death. Isby had practically held her breath until they'd cleared the area, and barely exhaled until they reached the land bridge connecting Arbon and Deluce through the small, neutral territory of Corain. Even here there's been little reprieve from the murmuring of Malfleur's rise. They say she hears everything. They say her defectors have been found stabbed in their beds. William helps Isby out of the hearse, and as her shoes touch the dewy grass, her legs wobble, leaden and numb.
"This is Isolay, where I leave you," the driver says hurriedly.
The waver in his voice betrays his regret in having aided in their secret plan. He is gone almost before the prince has a chance to slide a purse of coins into his hand with a quiet clink.
"What does it look like?" Isby asks.
William takes her shoulders and turns her. "Up a hill," he says, "surrounded by a high stone wall and rows of cypress." Isby has always imagined cypress trees like thick, furry soldiers, stiff and orderly. "The sky is awash of variegated white fog," the prince goes on, his voice moving closer to her ear. "Like cow's milk, once it has begun to separate. Still, you can see the sun just about to set through the tops of the stone archways in the cloister and..."
"William," Isby says, "I didn't realize you could be so descriptive."
"You don't realize very much about me at all, Isabel." There's no note of sarcasm in his response. He is simply stating fact.
"Perhaps not." She wants to reach out and read his facial expression with her hands, like she would with Gil or Aurora, but she refrains. She had asked him if she could do so before, and he had refused her, without saying why. Instead, she marches up the incline in the direction he has pointed her, clenching and opening her palms as she walks, left to imagine the high ridge of his cheekbones, his serious mouth. Isolay, the desolate convent where the council had intended to deposit Isby. She tries to imagine a life of seclusion, nursing the sick, giving alms to the poor, spending hours in silent prayer. It's possible she never would have seen Aurora again. She's sure that's what the council wanted. As she makes her way up the hill beside William, she hears women's voices chanting, evening vespers, the last prayers before sundown. She hears something else, too, the ding of metal on earth, shovels or pickaxes. They enter through the cemetery, which smells of solemnity, sage and skunk.
"Sisters," the prince says in polite deference.
The dull metal clanging stops. They must be digging a grave, Isby realizes. There are two or three of them at most.
"'Tis it you need?"
one of the nuns asks.
"Sick calls commence at 7 in the morning."
"We're seeking temporary asylum here."
There's a silence, during which Isby figures the nuns are taking in their appearance. She can hardly fathom her own, even in the clean cloak and travelling dress William procured for her. Her hair no longer comes down farther than her chin. She has gotten even skinnier in the past few weeks. She probably looks like a ghost. And William beside her, said to be both tall and handsome, with the dark skin common of the Arbinians, must provide a stark contrast.
"Aren't any free beds in the daughter?" one of them whispers. "And now's not a good time." "Psst, Sister Catherine," a second nun interrupts.
Her voice is a thin hiss, and Isby pictures the pointed face and sharp, pronged tongue of a snake.
"It is not for us to say. Sister Agnes will summon Reverend Mother Hildegard. She will make the decision about what to do with our visitors." "Yes, Sister Genevieve," says a third, quieter than the other two. "Please," she says to Isby and William, with a rabbit-like sniff. "Follow me."
They follow Sister Agnes through the graveyard, into the cloisters, and then into a building that the sister tells them is the calefactory.
"Only warm spot in all of the convent," she explains, stroking the big fire, whose heat sparks out, penetrating the entire space.
Isby is grateful for the warmth as she and William sit down on a long, narrow bench beside the roaring flames, while Sister Agnes leaves to find the prioress. She knows the calefactory is likely the only room other than the kitchen in which a fire is allowed. The sisters favour a life of deprivation. As if responding to her thoughts, William mutters,
"I've never understood the absolutism of religious practices. What sort of higher power would create fire in the first place, only to ask that his worshippers all but forego it?" Isby nods. It sounds exactly like the kind of thing a selfish dictator would do, or one of the Fae.
It would be both blasphemous and deeply unwise, says a booming female voice behind them, to compare our Heavenly Father to a corrupt fairy.
Reverend Mother, William says, standing quickly. Isby follows suit.
We only meant that...
I don't care what you meant, daughter. If history teaches us anything, Mother Hildegard says, it's that the intentions behind our statements matter far less than the way they're interpreted. Her presence is commanding, her voice fills the room, as pervasive as the heat of the flames. Men have warred and died for centuries over the interpretation of a few words. But of course, William says, with immaculate manners. In answer to your question, the prioress continues, I'd love to heat the daughter and refectory, but we can only afford the maintenance of a single fire. My women are too busy for chopping firewood. Pride reverberates from her voice like the echo of an empty wine barrel. A woman nearly as wide as she is tall, Isby guesses. Perhaps we may be of service to you, in exchange for shelter and protection from the elements, the prince says. We have a long journey ahead of us.
Here, the prioress says, handing them each a bucket. You may as well make yourselves useful while we talk. The water must be boiled and prepared for the laundry.
Isby can almost feel William tense in response to the demeaning task. Then again, the Reverend Mother doesn't know he's a prince. They take the buckets and place them on a rack over the flames. Sister Agnes returns with a cart full of dirty linens, and then the prioress dismisses her, so that they are once again alone in the calefactory. While William and Isby awkwardly attempt to wash the clothes, the prioress questions them about where they've come from and where they're going.
Reverend Mother, Isby says, we were driven from our village by supporters of Malfleur. We are travelling north to see my sister.
That part at least is true.
Your sister?
She's at the Delusian Palace. Again, it's the truth. Even if Isby is gambling on the fact that the prioress will interpret her words to mean that her sister is employed by the palace, not its royal heir.
You're planning to head straight toward the sleeping sickness?
We don't have any other options, William replies.
So will you house us tonight? Isby asks, feeling anxious as she wrings out a cloth. She wishes she could see the Reverend Mother's face.
The prioress is quiet for a moment. Finally, she answers.
Yes, but you must do me a favour.
Anything, William quickly says. We are happy to perform any other chores you may wish.
You must bring a message to the palace for me. The council has failed on a promise.
I'm sorry? Isby asks, confused.
16 years ago, when I was still chief minister to King Henri, he and I came to an agreement.
Isby stands there in astonished silence, a drenched sheet heavy and dripping from her raw hands. The prioress was once on the king's council, and during Isby's lifetime. How did she not know this?
Perhaps hard to believe now, the prioress says,
obviously in answer to Isby's stunned expression.
But at one time his highness had many female advisers.
Her father had many female advisers. This is news to Isby. She knows only that he had many mistresses. But quite a bit changed after her father married Queen Amelie, and Aurora was born. The prioress continues speaking.
I was to accept his bastard daughter upon the eve of the wedding of Princess Aurora, in exchange for a healthy sum to fund my orphanage. It was a fair enough arrangement, but years have gone by. The princess has succumbed to disease. The young woman I was expecting never arrived, nor did the money. Now our granary is empty, and we are up to 24 orphan girls here at the convent, all of them lacking proper winter clothing, food and supplies. One of the girls, Josette, only 6 years old, is suffering from pneumonia. I fear she won't live to see spring. Still, my requests have fallen on deaf, or should I say sleeping, ears. I ask only for what was promised me.
Now Isby's mind reels. The king had promised to send his bastard daughter here. She is the bastard daughter. Isby had no idea that the council had been intending not just to send her away, but to deliver much-needed finances to help the lives of orphans. She hadn't even realized Isolée housed orphans at all. Guilt prickles her throat and becomes a wrenching pain as she swallows it down into her throat. If she hadn't run off with Gilbert, if she had instead followed through with the council's plan for her, would these 24 orphans be better off? Would little Josette have a better chance of surviving? She's tempted to say something, to admit her identity, to claim responsibility, to vow at least that once the curse has been reversed, once Aurora is healthy and restored to power, Isby will do everything she can to make sure Hildegard gets the support she has sought from the palace. But she knows she can't say any of this. With the royals dying and Malfleur on the rise, it simply isn't safe to reveal her identity, even if she is merely a bastard. More importantly, she isn't in any position to make hollow promises. She doesn't know what will happen when she reaches her sister, if she reaches her. She must be gawking, because the prince nudges her in the ribs with his elbow. "As you wish, mother," he says. "Yes," Isby stumbles and turns her face down, hoping to disguise her discomfort. As you wish." William is instructed to sleep alone in a tiny guest room off the scriptorium, which, it turns out, is really an impressive library. Isby, on the other hand, is given a straw mat on the floor of the Califactory, alongside the orphan girls, who come flooding into the room silently after their supper, the hurried patter of their little shoes the only indication of their size and number. There's not a single whisper or giggle among them. Isby marvels at how well-behaved they are. It's like a room full of young Auroras. Though they've put out the fire for the night, the room is comparatively cozy, and Isby is grateful to be crowded in all sides by the warm bodies and soft snores of the girls. But still, she can't sleep. When she tries, she dreams of Gil, of his hands holding her against the rocking rail of the ship, his body so close to hers, sheltering her from the worst of the freezing, violent wind, his kiss so sudden, so unexplained. And then his name wants to dislodge itself from her chest and fly out, calling for him. It's not very late. The sisters all go to bed almost as soon as the sun sets and get up well before it rises for early prayer. Isby lies there, trapped in the tomb of her dark thoughts. Every way she turns, there's an invisible wall pushing in on her. She can't get Mother Hildegard's voice out of her head. She can't stop thinking about her father, how he banned all his mistresses from the royal court. Around the same time that the prioress claims to have struck a deal with him. Is it possible the prioress had been more than just an advisor to the king? The thought causes heat to boil in her stomach, bubbling up into Isby's head. Was Hildegard one of her father's mistresses? And then the shadow of that question looms behind it. Could Hildegard in fact be Isby's mother? She tosses on her mat. The notion is staggering. It stands to reason that her mother, whoever she was, would have preferred her child to be raised in the palace. And why else would the chief minister have wanted her to be sent here once she was of age? What other value could a bastard half-princess have for the reverend mother? Something about it doesn't feel right to Isby, though. Hildegard's voice, she realizes, is not the one from her mother dreams. The voice that sings the rose lullaby to Isby in her sleep is softer, sweeter, more wavering. Still, should she trust the hazy convictions of a dream over the logic of the facts? If there's any chance the Reverend Mother is the same woman who birthed Isby and left her all those years ago, she has to know. But she can't simply ask Hildegard without drawing suspicion. Isby sits up. She must investigate. She must discover the truth. Carefully, she extricates herself from the group of sleeping girls and slips out of the Califactory into the courtyard, where she stops, trying to get her bearings. She wants to start in the scriptorium. She will have to awaken William so he can assist in reading the stored scrolls and letters. If what Hildegard says is true, then there must be correspondence between Isolée and the palace. And if that's the case, then surely one of the letters might hint at the true nature of the prioress's relationship to the king, and maybe even to her. The air echoing through the cloisters is crisp and cold. Wind whistles faintly through the dense needles of the cypresses, braiding threads of their woodsy odor across the dusk. On nights like this, Isby is reminded that she's inhaling the breath of ancient history, of those who lived and built civilizations and died out long ago. And this is the same air that will be breathed by the great, unimaginable tribes of the future. She once told Aurora that there is a scent of almostness, where there's a scent of alwaysness too. There will always be winters. There will always be loneliness. She moves quietly in the direction of the scriptorium, passing the refectory where they ate their meager supper of tough mutton and dry bread, and steps through a narrow stone doorway. She realizes this is not the scriptorium, but the infirmary, when the heavy herbal scent of medicine hits her nostrils. An older nun is snoring loudly in a corner, a sound like a wagon that has come off its wheel. Isby is about to duck out when she remembers something. "Gisette," she whispers. There's a stirring.
"Yes,"
comes the voice of a young girl. Isby slowly makes her way toward that voice, careful not to bang into any of the other beds and awaken the snoring nun. She kneels down beside Gisette's bed and takes the girl's hand. It is icy cold. Gisette coughs.
"What is it? Are you one of the travelers?"
"I am," Isby tells her. She wants to say more, but she can't tell that it's her fault the convent is owed money, that it might be her fault Gisette hasn't gotten better care.
"And are you really going all the way to the palace?"
There's awe in the girl's voice. "Yes."
"But aren't you afraid of the sickness? Or the evil fairy queen?"
she whispers. "I suppose I should be," Isby replies, realizing it's true.
"You remind me of Mother Hildegard," Gisette whispers.
Her word sends a shiver down Isby's spine.
"Tell me about her." "Reverend Mother knows about everything. She is said to have visions. I have seen her roll through fire and come away unburned."
Gisette's whispers get more excited with every detail.
"She has stood in freezing water in the winter for hours and not caught even a chill. She sometimes goes away for days, and we discover she has been meditating all that time within a tomb under the ground."
"What stories?" Isby says with a smile.
"They aren't stories. It is all true. There is something special about Mother Hildegard. Like you."
"There's nothing special about me."
"Yes,"
Gisette says simply.
"There is. I heard Sister Agnes whisper that you arrived here in a hearse. Is it true? Have you come from..."
The girl's voice drops lower.
"The other side."
"No," Isby whispers, a mixture of laughter and sadness bubbling in her throat.
"Are you dead?"
"Not that I know of." Gisette coughs again.
"I've read stories of the dead coming back."
"You know how to read?" Isby asks, startled.
"Of course,"
she cries, a little too loudly. Then, more quietly, she goes,
"Mother Hildegard teaches all of us to read, and to write too. She is very political."
Isby stifles a smile. Gisette doesn't seem to notice.
"Are you afraid to die?"
Isby thinks for a minute. "I suppose I am. But I'm more afraid of all I have to do before then."
"Me too,"
Gisette says. "Then you'd better get your sleep." She leans over and kisses Gisette's forehead.
"What was that for?"
the girl asks.
"You remind me of someone too,"
Isby whispers. William is not as easy to awaken. She has to physically shake him before he comes to with a startled intake of breath. "I was dreaming," he explains. "It was so real. I dreamed you had no sister, that you were the Princess of Deleuze, but were pretending not to be. That you had invented the idea of the sleeping sickness as a cover so no one would find out you had fled the palace in search of adventure." Isby doesn't know what to say to that at first. "I assure you, I'm not clever enough to have invented any of it. It's all too serious and all too real."
"I realize that. It was only a dream," William replies, though he seems to be saying so as much for his own benefit as for hers. "It's just..."
"What?"
"Nothing. Never mind."
"No, tell me what you were going to say," she presses.
"I can't shake the feeling, Isabel, that there's something you haven't told me."
"You think I'm lying to you?" Isby asks, truly surprised.
"Maybe not.
William answers. I just have a sense that there's more to you than I yet know.
Well, of course there is. We've only known each other a short time.
They pause for a moment, their breath coming and going, neither one saying anything. Then William grabs her hands.
I should have done this before, when you first asked me.
He guides her palms to his face. The gesture is startling, but Isby eagerly seizes the opportunity to scan his expression, to memorize his features, to fully take him in. Her fingers dance lightly across his full lips, much more pronounced than Gilbert's. His eyes are big and widely spaced. He has a prominent forehead, a regal forehead. His skin is smooth, except for a slight scar along his jaw.
Like I mentioned, he whispers by way of explanation, my brothers weren't very nice.
They sit there in the unlit guest quarters, a room hardly larger than a closet, Isby taking in what he has said and not said. Finally, she breaks the silence.
You're probably wondering why I woke you.
She hurriedly explains that she needs him to scan through the convent's stored documents, and to her relief, he readily agrees to help.
I won't be falling back to sleep any time soon anyway, he says.
She can't help but wonder if it's more than that. Maybe he's the one who longs to pretend he's someone else. Maybe he's the one who was looking for a reason to flee from his life in search of more.
They spend a while carefully combing through stacks of correspondence in the scriptorium, a room that tickles her lips with a taste of dust and worn hides, but fail to find any letters from the Delusian court.
Isby is beginning to feel frustrated.
Let's try another tactic. Perhaps there's something about Mother Hildegard herself that we can dig up, about her past before she came to Islay.
What is it exactly that you're hoping to uncover? The prince asks.
It's like I told you. I have reason to believe the prioress knows secrets relating to the late king, my father. Secrets that she might decide to hold over the palace in the future.
It's not a complete lie, but Isby isn't about to reveal the whole truth. The fact that she doesn't know her own mother's identity is humiliating and private. It doesn't concern William in the slightest.
Well, I've found something interesting. It doesn't pertain to King Henri per se, though, he says, handing her a piece of folded vellum.
What does it say?
It's a, well, a sort of medical or metaphysical analysis.
Of?
Of Mother Hildegard.
Read it to me,
she demands, quickly biting her lip in an attempt to hold in her impatience. William mutters to himself as he reads, sharing the highlights.
It seems a doctor was summoned to bear witness to the mother's miraculous capabilities. Withstanding extreme circumstances, handling fire while exhibiting no bodily harm, fasting for many days without visible effect, that sort of thing.
And?
Well, it seems the doctor decided that the prioress displays an inability to experience pain. He concludes here that this is a viable explanation of the miracles, and that it's also most likely she is barren.
Mother Hildegard is barren. Are you sure?
She hears William folding and unfolding the vellum.
I'm not sure of anything. I'm only reading to you what I see here. The doctor believed her to be incapable either of feeling pain or of bearing children. That's what it says.
It's true,
says someone from the doorway. It takes Isby a second to place the aspic voice.
Sister Genevieve.
Everyone knows Mother Hildegard couldn't have children of her own before she came here, she says.
Isby has the impression that each of the nun's statements is another fly lapped up by a forked tongue.
It's one of the reasons she entered the fold and began taking in orphans. She was married once before, you know.
Isby swallows.
We didn't mean to pry, we were only...
But she can't think of a proper excuse. She shifts her weight, wondering if the nun is going to report them to the Reverend Mother and have them thrown out into the cold. Instead, Sister Genevieve says,
It's all right. Visitors are often intensely curious about Mother Hildegard. She is quite extraordinary. However, if you have any questions, you may ask them of her directly, during daylight hours.
We're sorry to have disturbed you, William says. We didn't think anyone would be awake at this hour, he adds.
There is the briefest of pauses before Sister Genevieve replies,
I happen to have heard a noise and needed to check that an animal had not gotten into the granary.
We've had a problem with rodents. She clears her throat lightly. It would be my pleasure to escort you back to your sleeping quarters now, she says calmly but firmly. Isby steps toward her, and Genevieve holds out her thin arm to guide her. It's only once Isby is back among the sleeping orphans, lying on her mat and drifting off to sleep, that she pinpoints what has been bothering her since Sister Genevieve discovered her and William in the scriptorium. Certain oddities. First, Genevieve had appeared silently, unaccompanied by the faint crackle of a lantern's burning wick. Though perhaps that's not so peculiar. Maybe the nuns are taught to conserve oil. Second, she had claimed to be checking the granary for rats. But didn't Mother Hildegard explicitly say their granary was empty? Still, it's possible the prioress had been exaggerating. However, the third peculiarity is what has Isby quite convinced that the sister, despite her divine oath of truth, was lying. The scent on the nun's hands. They smelled like fresh dirt, like rust, and like blood. 25. Aurora.
Marigold?
But the girl really is gone, and Aurora's voice, disembodied, echoes through the woods. The sun has set, darkness has risen. The night surrounds Aurora now, throbs with that same anticipation it always has, making her yearn for Isabel, for home, for Heath, for everything to be different than it is, for something to begin, for something that she has already inexplicably lost. A hand clamps down on her shoulder. A beauty like you shouldn't be wandering the night alone. Aurora turns around and makes out the figure emerging from the darkness.
Heath!
She sighs in relief. He's just as breathless as she is.
How did you find me?
My notes were missing. It wasn't hard to guess where you'd gone. I heard the waterfall. I feared. He clears his throat. I followed the river downstream and then I saw the trail. And that's when I really got worried.
The trail?
Of scattered flowers. You met Marigold, didn't you?
She nods, swallowing hard.
She's disappeared.
She only exists in daylight, he explains, as if it were the most natural thing. Lucky for you, he adds, his expression clouding over. What were you doing out here anyway? I told you not to come back to the borderlands. You could have died. I'm surprised you didn't try to drown you.
Aurora shakes her head.
She was helpless. She's just a little girl.
I have more than once come upon one of these lying on the ground near the cliff's edge, he says, holding up the flower wreath, only to discover the bloodied mess of some poor fellow smashed into the rocks below.
A shiver runs up Aurora's neck, but she will not be scolded, not for the bravest thing she has ever done, saving someone's life.
Well, she didn't hurt me. In fact, she may have helped me.
Her confidence begins to return. The cottage, the words in the wood, the clues.
Heath, I think I've learned something new about the Queen.
A powerful, angry crack ricochets around them, cutting her off.
A storm is coming, he says. We need to get back to Blackthorn. Now.
He starts off into a dense knot of trees and branches.
Heath,
she says, surprised by how good it feels to shout, as though the thunder has crept inside her throat and become part of her. He turns.
What?
We should go this way,
she says, and begins to run. Let him follow her this time. The sky fractures as she enters a clearing. A rain gushes down, instantly drenching her. She blinks against the heavy rain, taking in the massive bruise of sky above, swollen and torn through with lightning. She tries to listen to her heart, to the rose lullaby that lives inside her, an internal compass. Heath catches up to her, and neither of them says anything. The sudden storm brews powerfully around them. When lightning flashes again, it lights up the entire woods, and Aurora gets a good look at Heath's face. He's staring at her in wonder. Gone are the concern, the skepticism, the sickening disappointment she swore she saw in his eyes during the past few days. He has not, she realizes quickly, underestimated her. But she has underestimated herself. She breathes deeply. The musky, wet forest smells of some lure her one away. But there's a voice, an urge lower beneath that call, a message of truth cutting through the dreaminess of the storm. Once again, she knows which direction to go. She can feel the way back to the wall, back to Blackthorn, back to the Queen. The wind tears past Aurora, nearly knocking her over as she leads Heath through a thick cluster of trees. The rain pounds down her face, blurring her vision as they push deeper into the aching, pulsing blackness of the forest. Thunder rages. The storm is moving swiftly. If it keeps heading this way, they could easily be struck. The wall flashes before her, its grey stones shine in the lightning. Then Aurora is lightning as she and Heath hurtle across the illusion. Pushing through the wall feels different this time. She doesn't need to sing or even think the lullaby. She only needs to be, immutably, Aurora. Instead of trapped in the wall's coldness, she feels only euphoria, a shot of pure joy, at her ability to fly to the other side unharmed. The meadows of the Blackthorn Estate open up before her, and she runs not from the storm and not to safety, but for the easy pleasure of her body moving through space and time. A laugh bursts out of her chest, carrying Aurora's new aliveness in its wild sound. She is powerful. She is free. At the next bang of thunder, Heath grabs her hand and they cover the rest of the distance to the castle together. Inside, Heath lights a lantern and Aurora sees that they have come through a side entrance into a gallery. The room is drafty, cool and empty, the walls lined in paintings with a few sculptures on pedestals scattered throughout the space. She has wandered through here before, but only in passing. They stand facing each other, water droplets softly plinking to the floor. A raindrop runs down Aurora's brow and cheek, trickling into the corner of her lips. Heath runs his hand through his hair, which is dark with rain. He seems at a loss for words, a half-smile tugging at his mouth, caught, probably, between reprimanding her and something else. The electricity of the storm has followed them, and Aurora shivers, wanting to touch his dripping cloak, his collar, his chin, to let the lightning shock within her travel out. But she doesn't. "We should get you dried off," he says. A puddle is rapidly forming around both their feet. "Storms are reckless creatures," he adds. "We could have been killed." Aurora nods, but remains wordless. She steps away from Heath, trying to catch her breath, to remind herself of the important discovery she made today at the cottage. Rain beats against the shutters, and her eyes start to focus in the dim light. A giant painting looms before her. It's a large portrait of a young man on a horse. The man is handsome, with wide shoulders and a straight back. His light brown hair is cropped at his shoulders, and a thin beard outlines his square jaw, more filled in than Heath's faint stubble, but not the full beard of an older man. He appears to be around their age, and on his head sits a very simple crown, an oddly familiar circlet of gold, worn low on the forehead. No jewels. She hadn't really noticed the painting before, but then again, she hadn't been looking for signs of a thwarted romance until now. Her mind swirls with questions. Something about the lush painting has captivated her attention. "Charles Blackthorn." She's startled from her thoughts by Heath's voice, warm and close to her neck. "People say he went mad over a woman."
"Charles?" Heath nods.
"I didn't want to tell you, but that's why the tower room was empty before you came. People avoid it. They think it's haunted. They say his ghost comes back, looking for his one true love."
His one true love. And then she remembers. She saw the letters CB carved with a childlike scrawl among the other initials on the walls of the cottage in the borderlands. Could this be the love story she's seeking? The reason for Belcur's madness? Could Charles be the visitor Belcur believes she is waiting for? If so, and if he really did die many years ago, then the Queen will be waiting forever. Which means there's a chance they really won't ever escape Samae. Though escape is no longer the word she would use, that would imply a desire to leave all of it behind.
"Luckily, I don't believe in ghosts," Heath goes on. "Or true love, for that matter."
Aurora balks. "You don't believe in true love? That's ridiculous."
"Is it? What proof do you have that it exists?" he asks. He seems to be leaning in closer to her.
It isn't something to be proven." She's breathing slowly. His closeness is making her unsteady. "It's just something you feel," she says, thinking of the many epic tales of love she has read. "And when you feel it, you know."
He tilts his head, smirking just a little. "Sounds like the stuff of stories."
Well, what evidence do you have that it doesn't exist? She challenges. This heady mix of frustration and determination is beginning to feel familiar, and not in a bad way. She finds she likes that he contradicts her, that he's willing to debate, that he expects her to argue her side, and that, with her newfound voice, she can. Now his face is so near, she can feel his breath. Just that I've never felt it before. That kind of love involves choice, or it should, and that's something I've never had. You can't have choice if you don't have freedom.
Then I hope that changes, Aurora whispers. Everyone deserves true love.
I'm not so sure I agree. I've heard of people doing terrible things in the name of true love. Wouldn't want to end up like old Blackthorn, mad and alone.
But if you don't believe in love, then you will end up alone.
She blinks as her words settle into the narrow gap between their bodies. His lips seem to loom before hers, heart-shaped and soft-looking, even as they quiver into a smile.
Maybe so, he whispers back, lifting his hand to touch her face.
He brushes a strand of wet hair off her cheek. As his fingers make contact with her skin, she shivers. He leans back slightly and she remembers she's still drenched. Thunder crashes beyond the walls and rain pounds the roof, heavy and whooshing, as though an entire ocean has opened up in the sky.
Let me build a fire, Heath suggests.
You must be cold. But he doesn't move to the hearth. He stands there, staring at her, his lips slightly parted. Plenty of men have gazed at Aurora with something akin to hunger, but none of them knew her. None of them could.
You, he shakes his head, his long hair swinging in front of his eyes. You make me want things.
He licks his lower lip nervously. She stares at his mouth, horrified at the fire that instantly rages through her.
You make me want to believe in other worlds, he goes on. In other possibilities. And I should hate you for that, he says, though there's a smile still trying to cut across a stricken look on his face.
She swallows.
I'm sorry.
Like everything about Samae, his words leave her tingling with dissatisfaction, with the fear that she will never be satisfied, never get what she wants, even if she doesn't know what that is. Or perhaps because she doesn't know.
Don't be.
His voice is so quiet, she almost doesn't hear him. But something begins to rise within her, tightening around her lungs like vines. She always thought love would come to her just as it did in the romances she read. Full-blown and overpowering. Absolute and unquestioning. What's happening to her now is nothing like that. It's tremulous, curious, speckled with dangers and uncertainties. But he can't seem to finish what he was going to say. She puts her hand on his shoulder, a small gesture but infinitely bold, bigger even than when she touched the spinning wheel and its sting changed her forever. He seems to know this. He takes her hand and lifts it to his lips. He kisses her knuckles softly, hesitantly. His lips linger on her skin, sending currents of warmth through her arm and down her entire body. She feels light-headed as he tugs her closer to him, until his lips graze her ear, his breath tickling her neck.
Aurora.
An aching desire leaps up in her like flames in a breeze. Her lips catch the stubble on his chin, the high ridge of his cheekbone, still wet from the rain, then find their way to his mouth. She feels his surprised inhale, the way something clicks into place as his body goes firm and urgent against hers, and he begins to kiss her back. She is falling, into the divide between before and after. Her world is changing again, no longer simply with the miracle of touch, but this new discovery of how touch can have meaning. She feels the kiss everywhere, a tingling ache in her fingertips, a sigh against the backs of her knees, the kiss she didn't realize she'd been waiting for ever since meeting Heath, even when he had a dagger pointed at her throat. Her first kiss. The word oh drifts into the air around them as if on a swirl of fog. Aurora pulls away, enough to take a breath.
Oh,
a soft voice. Not hers, and not Heath's either. She turns. Wren.
The girl stands framed in the entrance to the gallery, her face pale, her fingers clenched together.
"Forgive me," she says, backing away. And then she's gone.
26. Isabel. Reverend Mother Hildegard keeps Isby and William busy for most of the morning. It turns out there are many grueling chores to be done and too few hands to do them all. But Isby hasn't stopped wondering about Sister Genevieve's appearance last night, that uncanny scent of blood and dirt and rust. She keeps imagining different scenarios. Sister Genevieve cutting her arm on a gardening hoe as she tends to vegetables, for example. Or perhaps Sister Genevieve discovering a rat in the granary and killing it with the sharp end of a pickaxe. Surely there are any number of possible explanations for her being out so late, and for her tending to the granary despite what the prioress said about it being empty. Still, Isby knows a lying voice when she hears one. Finally, during a break for the nuns to have their midday meal, she finds a moment to pull William aside. They pass the daughter, the refectory, and the bell tower, turning the corner through the cloisters and moving across the graveyard to the granary at the far side of the complex. William throws open the double doors to the large grain storage room, and Isby holds her breath.
"So, it is empty then," she says after a pause.
"Quite so. Hardly even a trace of wheat on the stone floor," William confirms. "It looks as though the floors have been recently swept, in fact."
"Perhaps to keep the vermin away," Isby says, thinking. She's, truth be told, a little disappointed, though she's not sure what sort of secret she thought she'd discover.
They decide to return to the refectory, hoping to catch a scrap of bread before the meal has been cleared. But upon passing once again through the graveyard, its scent of sage and cypress and new-turned dirt gives Isby pause. She pulls back on William's arm, and they stop out in the open. She can feel the sun on her wrists and face.
"Is there another fresh grave?" she asks.
William hesitates, scanning the area. "Possibly."
"Weren't the sisters digging one just yesterday when we arrived? Is it the same plot?"
"I'm not sure." Isby sighs, frustrated. She knows she should let go of the apprehensive nag in the back of her mind, but it's like a piece of snagged cloth that won't come loose. William clears his throat.
"Isabel, what are you really after here? Why are you so curious about Hildegard and the others?"
She shakes her head, feeling a lump of annoyance lodged in her throat. She doesn't want to explain it to him, and yet the words begin to form of their own accord.
"She knew the king, my father."
"Sure, but what's in that? Many people knew the king well. I can only assume."
"I thought she might be..."
Her voice is a ragged whisper.
"I thought perhaps she might know something about who my mother was. Just take me to the fresh grave, please."
She hears William sigh quietly, as though he's attempting to hide it.
"Very well," he says, leading her there.
She kneels down in the soft earth. She is not very accustomed to praying. She closes her eyes because that's what one is supposed to do. She puts her hands together and her head down. She knows she needs to stop trying to find answers. This journey isn't about her, or finding out who her mother was. This is about saving Aurora, her sister, her closest friend, the person who knows her better than anyone in the world. The only person, in fact, who has ever cared about what happens to Isby. Failing her is not an option. Isby places her palms into the earth. Whatever soul is buried here, Isby hopes he or she is in peace. She gives the damp ground one final pat, and is about to get to her feet when she reconsiders. There had been a touch of something cold, something hard. She pats the earth near the grave again, then pushes aside loose dirt.
"William," she gasps, "there's something under here. There's..."
She begins eagerly, moving clumps of dirt aside with both hands. She feels metal. She feels a...
handle.
She lifts her hand, dirt now caked into her fingernails. She is holding a dagger.
"Now that is odd," the prince says, kneeling beside her.
She runs her fingers rapidly over the hilt, feeling the careful carvings in the wood.
"William, it's not just any bodkin. It's got an insignia printed on it. It's..."
A hawk perched on a sword.
"The Arbinian seal,"
The prince's voice has gone cold as the blade in her hand.
How would this have gotten here? Why would it be buried in the ground like this?
Isby's fingers tremble with a mix of excitement and dread.